Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today on The Morning Show, President Trump's lawyer continued to insist the president is not under investigation, despite the president's tweet on Friday in which he wrote, "I am being investigated," and despite pushback from hosts like Fox's Chris Wallace that, in fact, the president has no idea if he's being investigated or not, because subjects don't always know. The president was on Twitter today, writing, "The Dems want to stop tax cuts, good health care, and border security. Their Obamacare is dead. Vote now for Karen H." That's a reference to Republican Karen Handel, who's in a tight race in a red district in Georgia with Democrat John Ossoff in tomorrow's special election, now the most expensive House race in U.S. history. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor, is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Robin.
I want to start with just by listening to a little of the exchange between Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace and Trump's lawyer Jay Sekulow yesterday. Sekulow making the rounds because of the president's Friday tweet. And Sekulow saying the president is not under investigation. But he then contradicted himself and said Donald Trump was being investigated for firing FBI Director James Comey. So let's listen. Starts with Wallace.
You just said,
no,
sir,
not being investigated.
That you just said that he's being investigated.
No, Chris, I said that the let me be crystal clear so you completely understand. We have not received, nor are we aware of any investigation of the President of the United States.
Sir, you just said two times that he's being investigated.
And then Chris Wallace went on to say Sekulow can't really know the president is not under investigation because subjects aren't told. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I watched that interview. It was very odd. But Sekulow, I think, had misspoke and was trying to create a scenario for Wallace to interpret, but the thread kind of got lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, though, we're seeing a consistent theme from this White House that anytime they're pressed, they are constantly on defense, especially on this subject matter. You know, Trump this morning deleted a tweet saying that Sekulow, promoting that Sekulow was going to be on Fox and Friends coming up shortly. That got taken off. Don't know exactly why. Reached out to the White House. Haven't heard back on that. But apparently that tweet seems to suggest that the president was pretty happy with Sekulow's performance. And why not for this White House? They certainly like to keep the media guessing on what exactly is going on. And their priority is not exactly giving clear answers.
Well, any investigation of the president would have to do, we think, we don't know, with obstruction. On Wednesday, though, the Senate Intelligence Committee will hold a hearing on Russian election hacking. What kind of questions will both sides be asking?
Well, you know, so far we've seen a lot that basically comes down to leaks versus collusion. You know, I'd added up a number of times that Democrats and Republicans asked about either subject, and Democrats focus on Russia and Republicans tend to focus on leaks. What we might find out this week, though, is what has been least talked about, which is how Russia actually tried to hack voting systems, what their efforts were. And remember, before we got any of that information shared from the contractor in Georgia who was then arrested, we didn't know that Russia actually had this complicated process to try to go into voting systems. So that may be something that winds up coming up this week.
I want to ask you quickly about health care. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants senators to negotiate their version of health care reform by July 4th before Congress leaves for a month-long recess. How angry are both Democrats and Republicans that this is a secret process? And do you think it'll get done?
Well, you know, he wants to get it done by the July 4th break for a specific reason. He needs to get this out of the way before he can move on to tax reform. He's trying to do it in behind closed doors, controversially, because public relations-wise, they don't want to take a beating over this. And I think McConnell is fine with letting it fail. If it fails, it fails, and he sends a message to the White House. If it fails, then they get to move on to tax reform, which is way more important to conservatives in many respects than actually getting a replacement bill through for health care.
Yeah. Well, there's that big special election in Georgia tomorrow. We're going to be hearing more about that in just a minute. But the Republican, Karen Handel, fighting to hold on to this longtime red seat. The Democrat, John Ossoff, looking to take it away. And then yesterday came this ad from a little-known political action committee, the Principal PAC, accusing the unhinged left of endorsing violence against Republicans, leading to that shooting at the Republican baseball practice. Let's listen.
The same unhinged leftists cheering last week's shooting are all backing John Ossoff. And if he wins, they win. Stop them. Stop them now.
Now, Domenico, we have to say we haven't seen anyone cheering that shooting by a Bernie Sanders supporter. And both the Republican and the Democrat in this Georgia race are decrying that ad. But do you think that shooting will have an impact on this race?
Well, special elections are low turnout affairs, generally speaking. So they usually are all about base turnout. So trying to fire up Republicans is an important thing for Republicans, given that Democrats seem to be the ones with the enthusiasm, but Republicans are the ones with the registration advantage, or more Republicans in this district. And I'll say one more thing about this district. It is the sixth most educated district in the country. The first five districts are Democratic districts, and this one is number six. And that's what Democrats are kind of hoping for, that perhaps there's some kind of realignment by education, and that this can bode somewhat well for 2018 if Democrats are able to pull it off. But, you know, special elections, I will say again, are not affairs that you should really put too much stock into predicting the future.
Well, they put more than stock in this one, put a lot of money in it. Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead politics editor, thank you.
Thank you.
And that election tomorrow in Georgia's 6th congressional district is not just a test for President Trump. It is also being seen as a test of young voter turnout. And with the Republican Karen Handel, a 55-year-old former Georgia Secretary of State, running against the Democrat John Ossoff, a 30-year-old filmmaker, the question for some is, will a younger candidate in the race make a difference with millennial voters? Sam Whitehead from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
It's Saturday afternoon in Georgia's 6th District, and a band wraps up their set for a modest crowd gathered at a soccer field in the city of Sandy Springs.
Thank you all for being here to rock your ass off!
From the puns to the small batch popsicle vendor, this rally is trending millennial. Democrat John Ossoff needs their votes.
My team tells me that if young people come out at twice the rate that they are expected to in a special election like this, that we'll win. So it is all up to y'all.
That's no small challenge. Younger people tend to vote at much lower rates than older folks. Ossoff could be positioned to change that. The documentary filmmaker and former political aide is just 30 years old, and that's a big part of why 19-year-old Nishat Firaj cast an early ballot for him.
I think it's actually really cool, and it's really easy to relate to him because he is so young. And I think it's also really inspiring for a lot of people like me who are young that we can make a difference too.
But young voters face real challenges. They're still new to the process and might not know basics like how to register or how to submit absentee ballots. That's why Georgette Dopkin co-founded GA 6th Youth Got This, a Democratic voter outreach group that targets millennials.
I think a lot of people often say, they're 18, it's time for them to figure it out on their own. And I don't really necessarily agree with that.
Dopkin's got two millennials of her own home from college for the summer and spent Saturday afternoon canvassing with her son in Cobb County. She says a few moms started the group. Now it's run mostly by young volunteers trying to drive turnout through social media. You might be thinking, this is just political helicopter parenting. Dopkin says it's not that simple.
As moms, you know, isn't it part of our duty to help them as they're making this transition to being adults? So it really, really was much more that than me telling my kids to get out of bed and go vote.
Then there are young Republican voters. A few recently came to a pizzeria in Chamblee to watch Democrat John Ossoff take on Republican Karen Handel in a televised debate. Spencer Goldstein is 27 and plans to vote for Handel. He says Ossoff's age makes him uncomfortable.
I always ask people, you know, how would you feel if I ran for Congress? And the answer is generally negative. I think you got to have more years under your belt to do this job.
I don't find that people my age are bonded in any way politically.
30-year-old Caroline Jameson says she's happy to see a fellow millennial running for office. But she's not voting for Ossoff. Instead, she's proudly supporting Handel, who's 25 years her senior.
I don't, you know, always blanket vote for the Republican Party, but I generally align with conservative principles.
But this race has become about more than just the 6th District. It's one of the first congressional contests since Donald Trump's inauguration. That's brought in national attention and the idea that the race is a referendum on the current administration. Kennesaw State University political scientist Kerwin Swint.
The energy and the enthusiasm on the Democratic side is propelled very much by an interest in giving Donald Trump a black eye and winning a House seat that has been reliably Republican.
That energy has motivated a lot of spending on both sides. Democratic and Republican groups from all over the country have poured more than $50 million into the contest, making it the most expensive House race ever. But elections come down to turnout, and Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie says Democrats have more on the line if young people don't vote.
In particular, because younger people in the United States are more likely to be of color, and people of color are more likely to be Democrats, this is something that would actually hurt Democrats more than it would hurt Republicans.
Still, Gillespie says neither campaign can afford to ignore any voters. Polls have put Hansel and Ossoff in a dead heat for weeks. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead in Atlanta.
Six members of President Trump's Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS have resigned. They say the president doesn't care about HIV and has no strategy to address the issue. One of those members stepping down is Scott Schottis. He's counsel and HIV project director at Lambda Legal, a nonprofit LGBT rights advocacy group. He joins us by Skype from Chicago. Scott, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And explain this decision of why you and five other members of this advisory council decided to make such a drastic move.
Well, it became clear to us that the administration was not listening to people living with HIV or the people that work in HIV, that they didn't care to engage with the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS and actually discuss these policy issues to inform the legislation, for instance, that they were working on, and that ultimately they pushed through a piece of legislation that will be devastating for the community of people living with HIV and our ability to fight the epidemic down the road. And at that point, we realized that we were not having the effect we wanted to have from within because we weren't being listened to, and that we would be better off going outside and making our case directly to the people, the public, and hopefully some of the senators that will actually be creating this legislation.
And the legislation that you're talking about that they pushed through is the Republican Health Care Act, correct, that passed the House?
That's absolutely correct. It is a bill that will make it much more difficult for people living with HIV to obtain coverage if they do not already have it, to afford coverage because the insurers are going to be able to once again start charging people with pre-existing conditions who fall off of the insurance rolls for any period of time, more difficult for them to get back in. In addition, the cuts that they are proposing to Medicaid, both the contraction of eligibility and then the cuts to the programs and handing over to the states how those cuts are going to be implemented, will have a tremendous effect. 40% of people living with HIV in this country are on Medicaid. And if you're going to cut back on those services, you're going to cut back on their health, prematurely potentially end their lives. And you're also going to create a situation where there are more infections down the road.
So were you able to bring these concerns to President Trump or to his top advisors before you left the council?
So we submitted a letter, which is how our work has always been done in the past. After our March meeting, we sent a letter to the administration outlining our concerns, our priorities for people living with HIV and the fight against this epidemic. We got a perfunctory letter from a lower-level official within the Department of Health and Human Services 2 months later, but there was no real engagement. And the fact is that it became clear to us when they were pushing the American Health Care Act, because there's no way you would engage on these topics and have read the letter and our suggestions and then go and create something that would remove so many people from the insurance rolls and impair our ability so greatly.
It should also be noted that President Trump's budget plan calls for big cuts to some of the services that the U.S. provides for people with HIV/AIDS in Africa.
Yeah, it's a problem not only domestically, but globally as well. And, you know, in today's epidemic, I think, first of all, it's important for people to realize that there is still an epidemic going on and that there is still, in this country, a pretty devastating effect on communities of color, on young gay and bisexual men, on transgender women, particularly transgender women of color, on low-income people really across the board. And by cutting these funds, you are really condemning those people to ill health and premature death.
At the same time, there are some who would look at your decision and the decision of these five others to leave this council and say, wouldn't you be better off on the inside than on the outside? Why not stay in and try to convince the administration to do what you want?
Yeah, that was absolutely a thought that we all had before deciding to resign. We did not resign the day after the election, but we did not resign the day of the inauguration when the White House took down the website for the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, which has yet to return over the next several months.
Have they explained that decision? Did they tell you why they did that?
No. We've gotten really no information has been conveyed to us at all, because I don't think that they're paying any attention to this issue whatsoever. Similarly, they did not appoint anyone to be the director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, which is really the voice of the community and the advocates that work on HIV to the White House. So there's no one in that position actually talking to the president. So we wanted to engage, but we didn't. So we didn't resign at that time. And we started and we had our meeting in March. It just became more and more apparent. And really, the American Health Care Act for me was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it's more like a 2x4 than a straw because of how horrible it would be for our community. And I'll also say, for some people, that might be the right decision. And I think the people who are staying, because there are 15 members left on this council, I hope that they are able to influence the policy from the inside. And I honor them for sticking there and doing it. I knew that for myself, I could be more effective and do more if I was freed from the constraints of what I could say publicly and how vociferously I could make my concerns known.
That's Scott Schottis, who is counsel and HIV project director at Lambda Legal. He's one of six who stepped down from the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS last week in protest of the president. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll link you to Scott's op-ed about resigning at hereandnow.org. This month, the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs backed off the department's 7-year-old target of getting to zero homeless vets across America. Secretary David Shulkin told the Military Times he's instead focused on cutting the current number of homeless vets down from about 40,000 to below 15,000. Nearly all facilities for homeless vets are co-ed. They house males and females together. But women, who make up nearly 15% of the U.S. Armed Forces, are the fastest growing demographic among homeless vets. And housing them with male homeless vets can be counterproductive for women recovering from trauma. Reporter Rebecca Shear introduces us to one of the nation's few programs that caters exclusively to the needs of female vets.
The federal government estimates that on any given night, 3,000 to 4,000 female veterans are homeless. But that estimate's probably on the low side, says Sarah Skoko, who directs the women's program of the nonprofit group Soldier On.
When people are doing homeless counts, they're going to shelters. They're seeing people on the street. A female veteran is not the person you see on the street holding a sign.
She might be a single mom. She may have experienced sexual trauma. So, says Skoko, these women are holing up in their cars. They're couch surfing. As a result,
the issue of female veteran homelessness is so underlooked, understudied. It's not understood because it's not in your face all the time.
So Soldier On decided to do its part by building a transitional housing facility just for women.
So welcome to the women's program.
In this bright and airy three-story building on the VA campus in Leeds, Massachusetts, the program houses 16 women and caters to their needs with things like art and yoga classes, support groups, and job counseling.
A lot of women that come to us have really lost everything. They've lost all sense of hope. And so all of what we do is build them back up.
Skoko says all the residents suffered some sort of trauma before, during, or after they served. 61-year-old Luann Hazelwood, who was in the Army in the 1970s and 80s, says her verbal, physical, and sexual trauma started early in life.
I more or less wanted to join the military as a way of escape.
But she experienced more trauma in the military after she got out, too. When she first came to the women's program, she was fleeing her second abusive marriage and was so traumatized she didn't speak. Being only around women made her feel safer.
I can't say I've ever really had a positive relationship with a man. And, you know, I have yet to totally trust being around a man. So for me, it was a way of recouping from all the abuse that I went through.
There's that commonality that each one of us faced some sort of adversity when we went into the military. You see that support and everything because some people really had to walk it alone.
33-year-old Paige Policastro is another resident of the program. She's a former Air Force technician and had struggled with depression and self-esteem issues long before she enlisted. Policastro thought being in the military might help.
I was thinking I was going to get some sort of approval and pat on the back.
Instead, she got verbally harassed.
You know, you're called a whore, fat.
And fell into a culture of drinking.
You party a lot. That's what happens. You work hard, you play hard.
And Policastro played especially hard.
I remember going through Walmart after work one day. This is when I was drinking, and I wanted to crawl under a rock and, like, die. Because a lady stopped with her daughter and pointed to me and said, "See, honey, that's a hero. Like, I'm supposed to be here protecting you. If I can't even help myself, what the hell am I doing?"
She confided in a therapist and says he threatened to have her thrown out. In the end, Policastro was allowed to resign with an honorable discharge. After rotating through several co-ed detox programs for veterans, she found the women's program.
Were you still drinking at that point?
Mm-hmm. I stopped, I think, like, the day or day before that I came in here. And I haven't had a drink since.
By 2020, the number of female veterans is expected to reach 2.2 million. So there's an intense need for more gender-specific services, says Director Sarah Skoko.
There are women that have served the hell out of our country, and they're not being recognized, and they need to be. They need to be treated, not the same way as males, but they need to be treated, period.
But demand for women-only services vastly exceeds supply. For these 16 rooms in Massachusetts, the women's program often has a waiting list and has received referrals and applications from as far away as Hawaii. For Here and Now, I'm Rebecca Shear.
And Rebecca's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
We're going to get two big reports on the housing market this week and how many homes are being sold. In January, existing home sales hit their highest level in about a decade, but that number has been slipping in recent months, and economists are expecting a weak spring selling season, partly because there aren't a lot of houses on the market. So what does that mean if you want to either buy or sell a home right now? Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And there is not a lot of inventory out there in many markets. We've talked before about how many baby boomers are holding on to their homes instead of downsizing. Is it a bad time to be a buyer right now?
Well, I can't say it's a bad time, but it's a tough time because there isn't, as you said, a lot of inventory. On the other hand, mortgage rates are still low. You can still get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for under 4%, presuming you have decent credit. And, you know, I think that mortgage lending standards have loosened up a little bit in the last few years as we get a little distance from the financial crisis. You know, I think that when we get down to it about the housing market, a lot of this is not so much about a good or a bad time in general, but is it a good or bad time for you? And that requires some work.
Well, how do you decide if it is a good time for you to buy?
I think that there's a number of factors. So number one would be you got to run the numbers. And that's the annoying part. It's like I'm giving you homework and you're about to embark on this fun thing. Sorry, guys. But, you know, until you really wrap your arms around what it costs to, say, have a mortgage and pay that interest and have your homeowner's insurance. Oh, and don't forget that you're going to have taxes. And then on top of that, you've got to have maintenance. And, you know, a lot of the folks that I've been talking to tell me I never expected to pay 1%, 2%, 3% of the purchase price of my home every year just to keep it up. So again, if you run the numbers, there's a lot of great calculators out there. There's actually one from the New York Times. It's literally called the New York Times Rent Versus Buy Calculator. Mm. And it helps you decide in your market, where is there opportunity? And I think until you do that, there is no way you should be going out and looking for a house.
What if you want to sell your house? How do you decide if it's a good time to sell?
Well, I mean, this presumes that you have some place to go. And, you know, I think that this is a big issue because, as you said, there are a lot of folks who said, hey, I'd love to downsize. But they look to see where they can downsize, and there's not a lot of availability there. So in my mind, you've got to know what you want to do. If you're ready to really make the move, you then have to probably hire the right realtor. I'm a fan of hiring a realtor. People do it on their own. I just think it's hard to do this. You've got to make sure that you are really dealing with somebody who has your interest at heart, meaning that, you know, it can be like your cousin who says, I sell gazillion-dollar homes, and you're like, okay, but mine's a $250,000 home. So someone who knows how to deal with someone like you.
Your cousin Vinny. No, he's a lawyer.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Do you then have to decide whether to do home improvements before you sell?
Well, this is when I think a realtor is very helpful. You know, we just sold my mother-in-law's house, and the realtor was great. And he literally said, you know, here are the things that I think you really have to do to get this house in shape. And until we do those things, we didn't even look at the setting the price. And I would say the next step in that is once you do the things you really need to do, not that you're not going to redo your whole kitchen, but setting that price is so important. The first 3 weeks of a home's entrance on the market are the most critical for creating interest and attracting buyers. And, you know, even though it's a tight market, no one's going to buy your house if it's overpriced. Right. So be careful in that part.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. We'll link you to more of Jill's tips at hereandnow.org. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Great writing can transport a reader, but books themselves usually aren't visual. That was a challenge that Andy Anway, founder of Amaze Designs, was faced with when his company began to design the American Writers Museum, which opened in Chicago last month. One solution, a waterless waterfall of words cascading in lights. On another project, Andy had to figure out what to do with billionaire Ross Perot's collection of statues, including a version of the Marine Corps War Memorial, his flag from the original USS Constitution, his first Bible printed in the U.S. What do you do with that stuff? Well, Andy Anway joins us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And start with the Writers Museum. Lucky those who have been there in Chicago. It sounds wonderful. But when you first heard about it, what were the thoughts?
Well, the biggest challenge with a museum like the Writers Museum is there's no artifacts. So it's a museum about ideas and trying to represent something that many people love. We all love to talk about books that we've read. It's like talking about movies. And how does one convey that in a museum setting where audience attention spans tend to be shorter than in a library or something like that?
Especially since those behind it were determined it's not about the best writing in America. It's about writers. And one of the people involved, I read, said, you know, writing is a democratic process and we want people to think these writers are just like us. So as a designer, what are some of the things that come to mind?
The aim was to try to make the museum accessible for all different levels of interest. So people that are casual readers, people that are literary scholars, and the way you do that is just to provide, you know, numerous ways into the material. So we have, you know, a lot of use of media, which allows people to do in-depth exploration.
Well, media, you've got typewriters, and people can just type. I bet there's people who have never seen a typewriter.
When we develop any museum, we would meet with educators as one part of our development. And the educators all told us, you can't learn about writing by reading about it. You have to write. We learn also that typewriters have quite a history. And, you know, there's a really interesting school of people who just study what has been written on what type of typewriter.
Huh. Well, there's also the scroll that Jack Kerouac wrote on.
Yeah, so the museum wants to have at least some artifacts. And this particular one, what better way to open than with this remarkable 120-foot-long scroll that was typed in 3 weeks by taping together onion skin. Mm-hmm. It's there through the generosity of Jim Irsay, who owns it, and loans it at no cost to anyone really who wants to display it.
The word waterfall. Is that your idea? What is that?
Yeah. We're looking for different ways into the material. If you're kind of looking at what's the arc of American literature from 1600s to today, there's a lot to cover. So we wanted to have a break from that in some places. So the word waterfall is a way it displays 10 specific quotes that kind of, you know, relate to what it means to be American, you know, what America is. The quotes range from quotes from Baldwin to George Carlin. You know, there's quite a mix. And the waterfall allows visitors to kind of stand in this environment where there's a soundtrack and just sort of witness these words appear and disappear with beautiful images cast on them as well.
So this spills over you?
Yeah. We wanted to have people walk into the space and immediately be surprised. that this, in fact, was not an Athenaeum or a library. There was no oak and no leather.
So that's the American Writers Museum. We'll have some pictures at herenow.org. But meantime, you have to immerse yourself in a lot of things to come up with the showcasing for something people are passionate about. I mean, that's what you do when you create a museum. So talk about Russ Perot hiring you to, I mean, he was never a president, so it's not a presidential library. He was a presidential candidate. What is it?
Yeah, so Russ Perot, what a fascinating person, full of energy, full of wit, and he is a consummate collector. We don't think he's ever thrown anything out. He was moving his office to a new campus facility that they were building in Dallas. So the first time the Perot companies were consolidating in a single building, he had a collection, has a collection of over 6,500 objects that had never been cataloged, that his children were unsure of what he had exactly.
Like what?
Lots of gifts from heads of state, personal memorabilia, things that people had given him. He was a championship horseman as a young man. He has the chaps from when he was 6 years old. He has Osama bin Laden's cane from Tora Bora that was given to him by special forces. Really quite an amazing collection.
Wow. He looks like he has larger than life-size figures, too. Looks like some sort of war figures.
He does. So he's commissioned a lot of, he calls them heroes. He's commissioned a lot of statues to commemorate individuals that he feels are, you know, should be commemorated for their contribution and patriotism. He's very, very involved, quietly, I might add, with the military. Despite what people might think of him from his public persona, he's a very humble and self-deprecating person who does a lot of stuff quietly on the side. He says, if a skinny kid from Texarkana can accomplish what I've accomplished, anybody can.
You know, a museum is sort of we've been talking about people's passions, and that's it. That's like, you know, it doesn't get higher than that. And again, you are responsible for helping them design it. I'm wondering if when it came to the African burial ground in Manhattan, this was a couple acres that's recently, air quotes, discovered because people knew it was there. You are white. This is a sacred place for blacks. What was your thinking going in there?
Well, that was a very challenging project for many reasons. Yes, our firm is predominantly white-owned, certainly. We had done prior to that job the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. We worked on several other African-American museums. And one of the reasons, of course, I would just say, you know, reason why a white firm would do this project is there needs to be still more African-American designers. There's a dearth of them in the architecture field and even worse in the exhibit design field. So that's just a call out for you know, an
invitation.
Send
your resumes to Amaze Design.
Exactly. However, that said, the project was extremely challenging for the reasons you intimated, which is really that you had a discovery of human remains in the early 90s when the federal government attempted to excavate for a new federal office building. The federal government was not their proudest moment of kind of trying to hide the fact that those remains were sacred. And what you had is then the African-American community rising up and pushing back, forcing the government to pay attention to this space and the sacredness, actually, of the site. And the archaeology and anthropology that was done there was led by African-American scientists and, you know, led to the affirmation that this was a site that kind of had been swept under the rug and probably holds as many as 15,000 burials.
You know, you work in a field where you are asking people to come in and look at things. People walk around with things in their hands and look at things. Are you competing?
I don't think so, really. I mean, museums are such a unique experience if they're done well, you know, that there's really – in fact, it's been really interesting to watch what happens with handheld devices. There's been a lot of experimentation with app museum apps. And when people are looking at their apps, oftentimes that does keep them from actually looking at the things that are in the museum. What is interesting is that museum media that's actually embedded in the museum experience, that is very successful in helping people get a deeper experience. But I think we're finding that it's not competition, that in fact the kind of daily drumbeat of constantly tapping your tablet or your phone is actually counterpointed by walking in a space that has real objects, real things to look at, real ideas to consider. No, it's less repetitive. It's triggering different kinds of interest in your brain.
Yeah, just your thoughts on maybe a recent opening or a museum that you look at and you say, "Man, I wish that was mine." You know, museum envy.
Well, look, there's so many excellent museums out there.
I'm thinking of the African American.
Well, that's so. I was just going to say we actually had the privilege of working on the master planning for the African American. It's the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and I did go there just a couple months ago for the first time, and to see it in person and to experience it with people. I think that's the other thing that is the most exciting thing about museums. It is a social experience, you know. So you are witnessing, you're witness to other people's reactions, and they provoke reactions in you as well. So, for example, in that museum, looking at, let's say, the Emmett Till exhibit, which is just unbelievably powerful, people standing in line and exiting that experience with tears running down their eyes. And that's of all shapes, sizes, colors, and genders. You know, you cannot go through an experience like that without being moved. So I would cite that as a pretty high watermark.
And that's Andy Anway, who knows his watermarks. He's head of Amaze Designs, located here in Boston, very much involved in many museums, including the American Writers Museum in Chicago. Andy, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a partisan gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin that could potentially affect election maps across the country. At issue is whether Wisconsin's new election maps unfairly and unconstitutionally give advantages to Republican voters and marginalized Democratic voters. For more now, Emily Bazelon is with us. She's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
So tell us, first of all, more about the redistricting process and the resulting election maps that are being challenged in Wisconsin. What was the issue?
Well, what happened in Wisconsin is that the Republicans had control over the redistricting process because they controlled the assembly. And this is based on the 2010 census. And they redrew the district lines for the state assembly in a way that yielded a supermajority for Republicans. And this is, even though Wisconsin generally is a very purple state, it's a place where Obama won in 2012, but Trump won in 2016. It has one Democratic and one Republican senator. So you see a kind of even split in the electorate, but then a state assembly in which the lines are jiggered in a way that makes it easier for Republicans to remain in control.
And the court has heard gerrymandering cases before and has struck down election maps, but on the grounds that they discriminate against minority voters. It's never struck down a map because it discriminates against voters from a particular political party, right? So how significant is that?
You're right. And that makes this case very significant. The Supreme Court, in a big case in 2004, left open just a crack in the door to the idea that a partisan gerrymandering challenge could succeed. So we have this separate box for racial gerrymandering in which the court, because of the Voting Rights Act, does worry if voters are having their power diluted on the basis of race when district lines are drawn. But if you are gerrymandering because you're trying to help your party, you're trying to put more Democrats in office or more Republicans, that has generally been viewed as constitutional. However, Justice Kennedy in this 2004 decision held out a kind of space for a successful challenge if someone could come up with a workable method of explaining when gerrymandering goes too far. And the plaintiffs in this Wisconsin case won in the lower court, and they think they do have that kind of formula. And so now the question is how the Supreme Court, with Justice Kennedy at the center, will handle this challenge.
And when will they hear this case? Do we know?
They will hear this case presumably in the fall. It could be in the winter. There was another important development today, which was that by a vote of 5-4, the court did not allow the lower court order to go into effect, which would have required the legislature to redraw the lines in Wisconsin before the 2018 election. And so that decision, with Justice Kennedy siding with the conservatives, may suggest that he doesn't see this formula as like the whole grail of partisan gerrymandering, that in fact he is willing to stick with the kinds of lines that the Republicans were drawing in Wisconsin.
Are people still wondering whether he's going to resign this summer?
People have been speculating about that a lot. Now, some court watchers this morning said, well, the fact that they took this case and that he obviously has been the deciding vote suggests that he plans to stay around next term. That's a little too much reading of the tea leaves for me into this one case, but we will see.
All right. Well, the court also issued a number of decisions today, including one where the justices ruled unanimously that offensive or disparaging names can be trademarked. That case involved an Asian American band that wanted to trademark the name The Slants. What did the justices say there?
The justices said that this clause in the Federal Trademark Act that says that the government can reject a trademark because it's disparaging to people, in other words, because it's offensive, that that clause is a violation of the First Amendment. So in other words, the government should not have the power to reject a trademark application because a lawyer in the trademark office thinks, huh, The Slants is an ethnic slur. I don't really care if this is an Asian American band or someone else. I just don't think that's okay. That kind of judgment and rejection of a trademark is now unconstitutional.
In another very different First Amendment case today, the justices struck down a North Carolina law that banned convicted sex offenders from social media. What happened there?
That's right. So the state had a very broad prohibition against using social media once you are convicted of a sex offense. The person who challenged the law was just talking about a traffic ticket he'd gotten on Facebook. Nothing to do with his previous offense, nothing to do with sex offending or children. And the court said that's just too broad a prohibition. And there's a lot of language in Justice Kennedy's majority opinion about the importance of the internet as a kind of place where everybody is talking, a new sort of public square. And so the court is saying, look, to have a completely blanket prohibition where you say a former sex offender can't in any way communicate in a social media platform, that just is going too far.
Just a few seconds left, Emily, but what are the big cases we're waiting on?
We are waiting on a case called Trinity Lutheran that is about the Establishment Clause. It's about religion and whether a state that is providing aid that's goes to lots of different schools can deny it to a religious school. So this is a kind of flip inversion of what we usually think of as religion rights. And then we're waiting to see if the Supreme Court will take the case that President Trump wants it to take defending his travel ban.
That's Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and fellow at Yale Law School. Emily, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.